The candle had burned down to almost nothing by the time I woke up. I didn't realize I had fallen asleep at first. My cheek was pressed against the cold wood of the pew, and my neck ached with the specific, dull punishment of a position held too long without meaning to hold it. The chapel smelled of melted wax and old stone, that particular combination that exists nowhere else in the world, ancient and quiet and somehow outside of time. A thin gray light filtered through the narrow stained glass window above the altar, casting pale blues and greens across the floor in patterns that shifted whenever the wind moved the trees outside. I sat up slowly, pressing the heel of my hand against my sternum as if I could push the weight there back inside where it belonged. I had come here at, what, midnight maybe. After the third hour of waiting in the hallway outside the intensive care wing, after the nurse with the kind eyes had told me, gently but firmly, that there was nothing more I could do tonight, that I should rest. After I had walked past the family waiting room full of strangers clutching paper coffee cups and staring at nothing, and felt more alone inside that crowded room than I had ever felt in my entire life. So I had found the chapel instead. Nobody came to the hospital chapel at midnight except people who had run out of other options. I was 24 years old, and I had run out of options. My name is Lily. Lily Voss. And 3 days ago, my brother Eli had collapsed during a shift at the shipping yard where he worked. The same yard where he had worked every day for 6 years without complaint, without calling in sick, without once asking anyone for anything. He was 31. He was the only family I had left. And now he was lying somewhere above me on the fourth floor, breathing through machines while doctors used words I had to look up on my phone at 2 in the morning, sitting on a bathroom floor, trying to understand what was happening to the person I loved most. I hadn't told anyone at work. I hadn't called our neighbors, the Pelham family, who had always been kind to us and would have offered to bring food and sit with me, because I didn't know how to accept that kind of help without feeling like I was already grieving. And I wasn't going to grieve. I refused to. So I sat in the chapel alone, and I must have fallen asleep somewhere between my third silent argument with God and my second attempt to make a list of practical steps I could take in the morning. The candle guttered, almost gone. I pressed my palms flat against my thighs and breathed. That was when I noticed him. He was sitting at the far end of my pew. Not close. There were perhaps 4 feet of old wooden bench between us, but close enough that the fact of his presence hit me like stepping off a curb you didn't see coming. My whole body went rigid with surprise. I hadn't heard him enter. I hadn't heard anything. And yet there he sat, entirely still, as if he had always been there, and I was the one who had arrived late. He was large in a way that seemed almost architectural, the kind of size that reorganizes a room simply by being present in it. Dark braids fell past his shoulders, kept back from a face that was all hard angles and careful stillness. He wore dark clothing, not hospital clothes, not the clothes of someone who belonged in this building. And yet he sat with the particular quality of a person who belongs everywhere he chooses to be. His hands rested on his knees. His eyes were fixed on the small wooden cross above the altar. He was not praying. He was not crying. He was simply there, occupying silence the way very few people know how to do without making it uncomfortable. I stared at him for longer than was polite. He didn't look at me. I became suddenly aware of how I must appear. My pale blonde hair half fallen from its braid, the gray cloak I had grabbed on my way out of the apartment still wrapped around my shoulders, my eyes almost certainly swollen. I was not a person who looked composed at the best of times. I was not a person anyone looked at twice in a room full of people. I was the kind of woman who moved through crowds without parting them, who held doors for others and was thanked approximately half the time, who was told she was sweet in the tone that means forgettable. And yet something about the way he sat beside me, without speaking, without acknowledging me, without the social performance of pretending not to notice me either, felt strangely like being seen. I looked back at the altar. The last candle flame shivered once, and then held. Minutes passed. I couldn't tell how many, The chapel had its own relationship with time, and I had stopped trusting clocks 3 days ago anyway. "You don't have to leave," he said. His voice was low. Not soft, exactly. There was nothing fragile about it. But it was calibrated to this space, to the stone and the quiet and the careful dark. It didn't startle me the way I would have expected. It landed like something I had already heard and simply not registered until now. I turned to look at him. He still wasn't looking at me. "I wasn't planning to," I said. My voice came out rougher than I intended. Sleep scraped. "I live here now, apparently." Something moved at the corner of his mouth. Not quite a smile. More like the memory of one. "Fourth floor?" he asked. I blinked. "Yes. How did you..." "The fourth floor families end up here," he said simply. "The waiting room is too loud. This is quieter." He said it without pity, which was the only reason I didn't immediately want to escape the conversation. I had received so much pity in the last 3 days, from nurses, from the hospital social worker who had stopped me in the hallway, from the woman at the coffee cart who had noticed my face and given me a free cup. I didn't have the energy to refuse. Pity had its own smell, sharp and a little sour, and it made me feel like something already broken rather than something still in the process of deciding whether to break. He offered none of it. He simply stated a fact. "My brother," I said, though he hadn't asked. It's complicated. They keep using the word stable like it's a destination instead of just a rest stop. He nodded once. "Someone you love," I added, almost to myself, glancing at him again. "You're here for someone, too." He didn't answer immediately. The silence stretched in a way that would have been uncomfortable with anyone else, but somehow wasn't. "Yes," he said finally. And then nothing more. And somehow I understood, with a certainty I couldn't explain, that asking further would be the wrong thing to do. Some griefs are not ready to be spoken yet. Some people need to sit next to another human being in the dark without being required to explain themselves, and the kindest thing you can offer is simply to remain. So I remained. And so did he. The candle burned down to its base, flickered wildly for one dramatic moment, and went out. The chapel filled with a darkness that was softer than it had any right to be, the stained glass window still holding the faintest pre-dawn color, the whole space breathing around us like something alive. I don't know how much time passed. When the first real light began to press against the glass, turning the blues warmer, edging toward gold, I heard a sound in the hallway outside. Footsteps. More than one set, moving quickly, with purpose. The man beside me went very still in a different way than before. The previous stillness had been chosen. This one was instinctive. Every line of him sharpened. The chapel door opened. 3 people stood in the frame, 2 of them in the kind of dark, fitted clothing that suggested training rather than fashion, and 1 of them in hospital scrubs, looking deeply uncomfortable to be in the middle of whatever was happening. They were looking at the man beside me with an expression I had seen before, though never directed at a person sitting in a hospital chapel at 5 in the morning. It was deference. Absolute, unambiguous deference. "Your Majesty," the one on the left said, low and careful. "The council has been..." "I know," the man said. He rose. The movement was unhurried, but it changed everything about the room's geometry. He was taller than I had registered. The fur-lined, dark leather of his clothing caught the early light and held it differently than ordinary fabric would. "Your Majesty." I stared. He turned, and for the first time since I had noticed him, he looked directly at me. His eyes were a shade of blue that didn't quite match anything I had a word for. Not cold. Not warm. Something older than either. "I hope your brother recovers," he said. Quiet, certain, like a fact he had already decided. and then he walked out of the chapel, his people falling into formation around him, and the door swung shut behind them. And I was alone again with the dying dark, and the cold pew, and the faint smell of a candle that had just gone out. I sat there for a long time after that. Your Majesty. I pressed my hands together in my lap and looked at the empty space where he had been. The light kept coming. I didn't tell anyone about the man in the chapel, partly because I wasn't sure what I would say. I sat in the dark with someone who might be a king, and we didn't speak much, and somehow it was the most comforted I've felt in 3 days. That sentence didn't have a natural place in any conversation I could imagine having with a nurse or a hospital social worker. Or the Pelham family. When they finally called that morning and left a voicemail, I listened to, twice, before deciding I wasn't ready to return it. And partly because the moment I stepped back into the bright, humming reality of the fourth floor, the antiseptic smell, the soft, persistent beeping from behind closed doors, the squeaking of rubber-soled shoes on linoleum. The chapel felt like something I had dreamed. A space between spaces. A pause in a sentence too long to hold in one breath. But Eli was real. The machines were real. The doctor who found me at 8:15 that morning, while I was standing at the window at the end of the hallway watching the parking lot fill up with ordinary people living ordinary days, was real. Ms. Voss. Doctor, Inara Solis was a small woman with short, dark hair and the particular kind of tired that lives permanently in the eyes of people who do this work for years without burning out. I had decided on day one that I trusted her, based on no evidence except the way she always looked at me directly when she spoke. I was hoping to catch you. Can we sit down? We sat in the small consultation room with the box of tissues on the table and the window that looked out onto a brick wall. I had learned, in 3 days, that the rooms with the brick wall windows were where they took you when the news needed a container. But Dr. Solis didn't look like someone delivering the worst kind of news. She looked like someone who had found a door where there had previously only been wall. Eli's numbers shifted overnight, she said. There's a treatment. A specialist program, actually. Experimental in the sense that it's not widely available. But the outcomes have been significant. She paused. The program is run through the Varick Institute. It's a private medical research facility, about 40 miles north of the city. They have a bed available, and based on Eli's profile, he would qualify. I had my hands folded on the table. I kept them very still. The cost, I said, because that was always the sentence underneath every sentence in rooms like this one. Dr. Solis met my eyes. That's the unusual part. The program is fully funded. No cost to the patient or family. The Institute covers everything, including transport. She hesitated. It became available this morning, quite suddenly. I've never seen an opening come through this quickly, to be honest. I looked at the brick wall outside the window for a moment. This morning, quite suddenly. I thought about blue eyes and a voice calibrated to fit inside stone walls. I thought about the way he had said, "I hope your brother recovers." Not, "I hope he gets better." Not the usual soft and hedging language of someone offering comfort they can't guarantee. Certain. Like a fact he had already decided. I was not naive enough to believe in coincidences that convenient. But I also did not have the luxury of asking questions that might cause someone to reconsider an open door. "When can he be transferred?" I asked. The Varick Institute sat on the northern edge of the territory, where the city dissolved into tree line and the air changed quality within half a mile. Cleaner, colder, carrying the faint green smell of pine and something older underneath, like soil after rain that is soaked in deep. The building itself was long and low and built from pale stone, surrounded by grounds that were kept with the kind of meticulous care that communicates resources without needing to advertise them. I arrived with Eli in the transport at noon. He was still unconscious, still attached to monitors, but the transfer team had been professional and calm in a way that suggested they had done this many times and considered this particular run entirely routine. I sat beside the gurney and held my brother's hand. His fingers still rough from work, calloused in the specific patterns of someone who used his hands every day, and watched the city give way to trees and tried to understand what was happening to my life. A woman named Sable met us at the entrance. She was perhaps 40, with sharp cheekbones and dark skin, and the kind of efficient grace that suggested she had been in charge of things for a very long time and had no intention of stopping. She wore no uniform that I could identify, simply dark clothing and a small earpiece, and she introduced herself as the Institute's coordinator without offering a last name. Ms. Voss. She shook my hand with a firmness I appreciated. Eli will be taken directly to Wing 3. I'll walk you through the intake process, and then I'd like to show you to your room. My room? Family residence wing, she said, as if this were entirely standard. For the duration of his treatment. We find outcomes improve when family members are close. You're welcome to stay as long as you need. I followed her through corridors that smelled of clean linen and something faintly herbal, past walls hung with landscape paintings, forests and mountains, and one long shoreline under a storm-colored sky, and tried to recalibrate my understanding of what this place was. It was not what I had imagined when Dr. Solis said research facility. It was quieter than a hospital, warmer, with a quality of deliberateness to every detail that felt more like a house someone had thought very hard about than an institution. The people I passed moved with purpose, but not urgency. Nobody looked harried. Nobody looked afraid. My room had a window overlooking a courtyard where a single large oak tree was just beginning to turn, the edges of its leaves going amber and gold, the first translation of summer into autumn. A small writing desk. A bed with a wool blanket in a deep charcoal gray. A bookshelf already stocked with an odd assortment of titles. Field guides. Poetry collections. One thick history of medicinal plants with a cracked spine that suggested it had been read many times. I sat on the edge of the bed and put my face in my hands for exactly 60 seconds. I allowed myself that. Then I stood up, smoothed my cloak, and went to find where they had taken Eli. I did not see Lucian that first day. I learned his name from Sable, who mentioned it with the same brisk neutrality she used for everything else. The Institute was established under the Varick Family Trust, overseen by Lucian Varick, as if she were reading from a prospectus, as if the name did not connect directly to a dark chapel and a voice that had told me I didn't have to leave. Lucian Varick, the Alpha King. Those two identities sat beside each other in my mind, the way mismatched furniture sometimes ends up in the same room. Each of them clearly real, clearly functional, but requiring a moment of adjustment before the eye accepted them as belonging together. I had grown up in a world that knew about the packs. Everyone did. It wasn't a secret. Hadn't been for two generations, since the accord that formalized the boundary between pack territories and human cities, since the careful and ongoing negotiation of coexistence that most people on both sides found easier to ignore than to think about too hard. I had grown up in the city. The packs were something that happened north of the tree line, in territories with their own governance, their own law, their own hierarchies that I knew about only in the abstract. The Alpha King sat at the top of that hierarchy. Not just one pack, but all of them. The authority that the pack leaders themselves recognized. The figure around whom the whole complicated structure organized itself. And he had been sitting in a hospital chapel at 5 in the morning, alone, in the dark. I thought about that while I sat with Eli that first evening, watching his chest rise and fall with an evenness that the machines made reliable. The Wing 3 nurses, a young man named Cato, and an older woman who introduced herself only as Rue, moved around us with the same deliberate calm as everything else in this building. Cato explained the treatment schedule with patience and without condescension. Rue brought me tea, without asking whether I wanted any, which I thought was the right call. He's in a good place, Cato told me, before they dimmed the lights for the evening. The team here is very experienced with his specific condition. You should rest. I know, I said. I will. I didn't. Not right away. I went to the courtyard instead, where the oak tree held its turning leaves against a sky going dark and thick with stars, and I sat on the stone bench beneath it and listened to the particular silence of a place where the city couldn't reach. Wind through branches. Something moving in the trees beyond the wall. An animal. Small and unhurried. The smell of autumn arriving. You're not sleeping. I didn't jump this time. I was beginning to wonder if that said something alarming about my own psychology, or something else entirely. He was standing at the edge of the courtyard, partially in shadow. Still in dark clothing, still carrying that quality of deliberate stillness. But something was different here than in the chapel. He stood differently on this ground. Like a person in a room they belong to instead of a person choosing to occupy a space. Neither are you, I said. He moved to the other end of the bench and sat. Not close. The same careful distance as the chapel pew. 4 feet of space. No more. And no less. Your brother's intake went well, he said. I know. I looked at the tree. Thank you. For whatever that was. The opening that appeared suddenly. He was quiet for a moment. The bed was available. You're a terrible liar, I said. And then immediately pressed my lips together because I had just said that to a king. But the corner of his mouth did the thing again. That not-quite smile. That impression of something that might have been warmth in a different configuration. Get some rest, Lily, he said. And then, because I was apparently incapable of simply accepting that. You know my name. Sable is thorough, he said simply. He stood, and I looked up at him in the half-dark under the turning tree and felt, for the first time since Eli collapsed, that the ground under my feet had some substance to it, that I was not entirely alone in the middle of something too large to hold. Lucian, I said, just his name, testing whether it was allowed. He paused. Good night, I said. Something shifted in his expression. Not quite surprise, but the neighboring emotion. And then he nodded once, and walked back across the courtyard and through the door. And I was alone again with the stars and the tree and the smell of a season changing. I stayed another 10 minutes, just breathing. Then I went inside, and for the first time in 4 days, I slept. 2 weeks passed at the Varick Institute. The way time passes in places removed from ordinary rhythm. Not slowly, not quickly, but in its own particular current that you only notice when you look up and realize how far you've traveled without marking the distance. Eli improved. Not dramatically, not in the sudden cinematic way I had fantasized about during the dark hours of the first week. No moment where his eyes flew open and he looked at me and everything was resolved in a single breath. It happened the way real recoveries happen. Incrementally. Stubbornly. One small measurement at a time. His oxygen numbers climbed. The frequency of the alarms decreased. On day 9, he opened his eyes for 4 minutes, looked at me with an expression of profound confusion, said Lily. Why do you look terrible in a voice like gravel? And then went back to sleep. I put my face against the blanket at his knee and laughed until I cried. And Cato tactfully found somewhere else to be for a few minutes. But Eli was not recovered. He was recovering, which is a different country with a longer road, and I was learning the geography of it one day at a time. In the spaces between sitting with him, I began to learn the Institute. It was larger than it appeared from the entrance. The low stone building extended into wings I hadn't initially seen, connected by covered walkways that crossed through gardens in various states of seasonal transition. There was a library on the west end that smelled powerfully of old paper and cedarwood, with long tables and windows looking out onto the northern tree line. There was a dining hall that served meals at actual hours, with actual food, not the vending machine cycle I had settled into at the hospital, and where I discovered that approximately 30 other people lived and worked here on any given day. I had expected, I think, a place populated entirely by PAC members. I was not sure what I'd imagined exactly. Something more uniformly intimidating, perhaps. Something that would make my own presence feel more obviously incongruous. Instead, the Institute was a mixture. Researchers and medical staff who were human. PAC members who worked in various capacities. Some in the medical wing, some in what Sable described only as coordination. Some who seemed to simply live here as part of the broader household. The two groups navigated each other with a matter-of-fact ease that suggested long practice. I navigated both groups with the practiced invisibility I had spent a lifetime perfecting. Or I tried to. The problem was that in a community of 30 people, the kind of invisibility available in a city of millions simply doesn't function. People noticed me because there were few enough of them that everyone noticed everyone. Cato stopped by the library on his breaks and asked what I was reading. Rue, the older nurse, turned out to have opinions about medicinal plant history that she expressed with the particular enthusiasm of someone who had been waiting for an excuse, and the cracked-spined book on my shelf had apparently come from her personal collection. A young PAC member named Dara, perhaps 19, who seemed to be an apprentice of some kind, began appearing at meals at roughly the same time I did, and talking to me with a cheerful lack of ceremony that I found both disarming and exhausting in the best possible way. "You're the one who is in the chapel," Dara said on the third morning, helping herself to my toast without asking, which I found I didn't mind. I looked at her. "That got around?" "Everything gets around here." She said it without apology. Riven told Sable and Sable told... Well, it travels. She considered this. Riven was one of the people who came to find him that morning. He said you were just sitting there and you didn't even look scared of him, which apparently is notable. "I was mostly asleep," I said. "Still." She took a bite of toast. "People have been scared of Lucian since he was about 15. You might be the first person in this building who treats him like he's, you know, regular." "He's not very regular," I said honestly. "No," she agreed. "But it's different when someone just doesn't lead with the fear, you know? He notices that." I thought about this for the rest of the day. Lucian and I did not have a routine exactly. Routines are things you arrange. What we had was more like a pattern that established itself without either of us formally agreeing to it. The way water finds the same path down a hillside each time it rains without being directed there. He came to the courtyard most evenings. Not every evening. On the evenings he didn't come, I noticed his absence the way you notice a sound stopping that you hadn't consciously registered as a sound. I told myself this was simply because the pattern had established itself. Because humans are creatures of expectation. I told myself this very firmly, and then went inside and read Rue's medicinal plant book for 2 hours without absorbing a single sentence. On the evenings he did come, we talked. Not about important things at first. Not about anything that required courage. We talked about the oak tree, which he told me had been on the property longer than the building. We talked about the medicinal plant book, and I mentioned Rue's involvement with it. And he said that explains why the chapter on fever remedies is heavily annotated with a dryness that made me laugh. We talked about Eli. I told him about the gravel-voiced comment on day 9, and he listened with the quality of attention I was beginning to recognize as specific to him, the kind that made you feel that everything you said was worth the air it took to say it. I learned things about him the way you learn about a landscape. Gradually, by walking through it rather than by being handed a map. He didn't sleep well. I had intuited this from the chapel and confirmed it by the courtyard hours, which were often late. He carried something that I couldn't name yet. Some heaviness that sat in the set of his jaw and the particular stillness he defaulted to when he wasn't actively engaged. Not emptiness, but the opposite. A fullness of something unspoken. He had run the Varick Institute for 7 years, since he was 26, alongside his responsibilities to the PACs. He had built it, I understood gradually, not as a display of resources, but because he had needed it to exist, and it didn't. So he made it exist. The reason for that need, he didn't offer. And I didn't ask. I was learning the grammar of his silences. which ones were closed and which ones were simply waiting. On the 12th day, he asked me about myself. Not in a broad, sweeping way that would have required a performance. Just, what do you do before all of this? I work at an architectural preservation firm, I said. I document old buildings. The details people don't look at. The original fixtures. The structural elements that get covered over or altered. I write up the record so there's a history, even if the thing itself changes. I paused. It's not... People think it sounds dull. People who think preservation is dull have never lost something they couldn't get back, he said. I looked at him. He was looking at the tree. No, I agreed quietly. They haven't. The trouble arrived on day 14. I was in the library when I heard the voices. Not loud, but with the particular compressed quality of an argument being conducted through clenched teeth. I looked up from the table where I'd been working on the documentation forms I'd had forwarded from my office, belatedly realizing I still had a job and a life that hadn't paused simply because I had. Through the library's half-open door, in the corridor outside, I could make out two figures. One was Riven. I recognized him now, the taller of the two who had come for Lucian in the chapel, with the kind of watchful stillness that suggested military background. The other was a man I hadn't seen before. Older, silver-haired, with the bearing of someone who had been important for a very long time and intended to continue being so. The timing is irresponsible, the older man was saying. The council has been patient, but patience has a limit. And this... The king's schedule is not a council matter, Elder Doran. Riven's voice was even and immovable. His choices are absolutely a council matter when they reflect on... The older man paused. His eyes moved and met mine through the gap in the doorway. I looked back at my papers immediately. The human girl, Elder Doran said, lowering his voice in a way that somehow made it carry further. She's been here 2 weeks. People talk. People always talk, Riven said. The king is aware. A pause. He is not himself. Since Venna... The older man stopped. He carries too much, and now he is allowing distraction during a period when the eastern border situation requires... I'll pass along your concerns. Final, closed, not a conversation anymore. Footsteps. I stared at the preservation forms and did not move until the corridor was silent. Since Venna, a name... New information landing in the middle of everything I thought I was beginning to understand, reorienting the landscape without warning. I sat with it for a long time. That evening, the courtyard was empty. I sat under the oak tree for an hour in the cooling dark. The leaves were further gone now, more gold than green, a few beginning to let go and drift. Autumn was committing. I watched the leaves move, and thought about things I didn't have enough information to think clearly about, and tried not to feel the specific loneliness of having gotten used to a presence and finding the bench empty. At the hour mark, I stood up to go inside. The door opened. Lucian looked different. Not disheveled. He wasn't the kind of person who became disheveled, but there was something more exposed about him tonight, some layer that was usually present now conspicuously absent. He crossed the courtyard and stopped beside the bench. Eli spoke again today, he said. Cato told me. He asked for food. He asked for a specific sandwich from a specific place 3 miles from our apartment, I said. Cato had to explain that the delivery radius doesn't extend here. We can arrange it, Lucian said simply. You don't have to. I know I don't have to. I looked at him. In the dark, under the tree with its falling gold, he looked tired in a way that was neither weakness nor complaint. Just tired. Doran came today, I said carefully. His expression shifted slightly. You heard. Some, not everything. I paused. He mentioned a name. Venna. The silence that followed was the closed kind. I had already decided to let it close, to leave it alone. to respect the boundary, when he exhaled once, quiet and deliberate. "My sister," he said. "She was a patient here, 4 years ago. She didn't. The treatment wasn't enough." He stopped. "I built this place so that others might not have the same outcome. The building doesn't resolve the reason it was built. That's not how grief works." He said it plainly. Not performing vulnerability, not offering it as a gift. Just stating a true thing to another person who was sitting in the same dark. "No," I said, "it isn't." The oak dropped one leaf between us, slow and unhurried, and it settled on the stone of the bench. Neither of us spoke for a long time after that, but neither of us left. Elder Doran did not leave. I had half hoped, in the illogical way you hope for things you have no power over, that the conversation I'd overheard in the library corridor would resolve itself quietly, that Doran would deliver whatever message the council had sent him to deliver and return to wherever council elders came from, and the institute would settle back into its particular rhythm of clean linen and herbal smells and evenings under the oak tree. Instead, he stayed. And he brought two others with him. I learned their names from Dara, who had an effortless gift for information that she shared with the same casual generosity she applied to helping herself to other people's breakfast. Elder Marin, a woman in her 60s with silver-streaked hair and the kind of composed expression that gives nothing away and costs a great deal to maintain. Elder Cassian, younger than the other two, perhaps 50, with watchful eyes and a careful way of moving that reminded me of Riven, except where Riven's watchfulness felt protective, Cassian's felt evaluative, like someone conducting an ongoing assessment. They held meetings in the East Wing, long ones, the kind where people come out afterward wearing their faces slightly differently than when they went in. Riven looked tighter around the jaw each day. Sable, who I was beginning to understand as someone who kept the Institute's emotional temperature steady through sheer force of professional will, was doing something subtle with her scheduling that I couldn't quite decode, but that seemed designed to minimize intersections between the council elders and the medical wing where Eli was. Dara stopped talking at meals and started listening instead, which was a significant behavioral shift. I watched all of this the way I had learned to watch things at my preservation job, documenting what was there without yet interpreting it, gathering information before drawing conclusions. Lucian moved through the tension with a surface stillness that I was learning to read differently now. It wasn't absence. It was the opposite. A deliberate containment, the way a dam doesn't look like effort until you understand what it's holding back. He sat in the council meetings. He came out of them and walked the perimeter of the grounds in a circuit that Riven matched at a respectful distance. He appeared at dinner with the elders and conducted conversation with a courtesy so precise it functioned as a kind of armor. He still came to the courtyard. On the 15th evening, I had brought two cups of tea from the dining hall, the kind Rue had introduced me to, the herbal blend that smelled of pine and something smoky, and set one at his end of the bench before he arrived. When he sat down and looked at it, something moved briefly across his expression that I chose not to examine too closely. He picked up the cup. Didn't comment. Just drank. "The council wants you to return to the Central Territory," I said. "Not a question." He looked at the tree. "They want several things. Return is among them. What else?" A pause. "They believe my presence here, specifically my continued direct involvement with the Institute's operations, sends a message they find inconvenient, that I prioritize..." He stopped. "That my focus is misaligned with current territorial priorities." "The eastern border situation," I said. He turned to look at me. "I overheard more than I meant to," I said honestly. "I wasn't listening on purpose." The library door was open. He studied me for a moment with that particular quality of attention. "The eastern border has been a point of friction for 2 years. Three pack territories with overlapping historical claims and a new human development project cutting through the middle of the disputed land. It requires negotiation, presence, a series of meetings I have been conducting remotely for the past 3 weeks. Can you keep conducting them remotely? No. Simple. Undecorated. Doran is right that physical presence is necessary at this point. I've known this for 10 days. Then why? I stopped. He looked back at the tree. I understood, in the way you understand things that rearrange themselves quietly, rather than announcing the rearrangement. He had stayed because leaving felt like abandonment. And he had one experience of leaving that he was still living with. The institute he had built in the shape of that experience. And it still wasn't enough. And he came here in the dark because the alternative was sitting alone with the insufficiency of everything he had built. I didn't say any of this. Some things don't need saying to be understood. When do you need to go? I asked instead. 3 days, he said. Riven has been managing the logistics. Doran is... The corner of his mouth moved, dry rather than warm this time. Doran is relieved. And you? The question sat between us in the cooling air. I find, he said carefully, that I have become accustomed to certain things. He did not look at me when he said it. He kept his eyes on the oak tree, which was nearly bare now, the last of its gold leaves releasing in the slow evening wind. One at a time, with the unhurried certainty of something that had done this before, and would do it again. I looked at the tree too. I'll still be here, I said. Eli isn't well enough to leave yet. I'll be here for... I tried to calculate. Weeks, probably. Maybe longer. I know, he said. The Institute will still be here. I know that too. The wind moved through the bare branches and I heard, distantly, the sound of the building settling. That particular sound old stone makes in cooling air. A kind of deep structural breathing. The situation shifted on the 17th day in a way I had not predicted. I was with Eli when it happened. He was awake more consistently now, for longer stretches, and we had established a careful new rhythm of short conversations that didn't exhaust him. He was asking me about the Institute with the precise, detail-oriented curiosity that had always been his particular quality, wanting to understand the place he was in. The Alpha King built it? He said Alpha King with the careful neutrality of someone who has opinions he is choosing not to voice yet. His family's trust, I said. He runs it. And he just happened to be at the hospital that night. He was visiting someone, I said. Which was true as far as I knew, though I still didn't know the full particulars. He was in the chapel. And he sat with you. He sat near me. It's different. Eli looked at me with the expression he had been deploying since we were children. The one that meant I see exactly what you're doing, and I'm choosing to let you do it for now. But we will return to this. Even diminished by weeks of illness, even with the monitor pads on his chest and the careful pallor of someone still in the process of coming back, he could still produce that look with full precision. You seem different, he said. I'm tired. No. Well, yes. But also different in another way, he considered. Less compressed. You've always been like something carrying more than it shows. You seem less like that. I didn't have an answer for that. I smoothed the blanket at the edge of his bed and said I'd let him rest. I was in the corridor outside his room, leaning against the wall and looking at the ceiling, when I heard the raised voice from the east wing. Not the compressed, careful arguing of the previous days. This was something else, a voice I didn't recognize, elevated well beyond professional control, with the specific, sharp edge of someone who is not accustomed to feeling powerless and is therefore not handling it gracefully. Then another voice, low and even and unmistakable. Lucian. Then silence. Then Riven appeared at the far end of the corridor, saw me, and changed direction slightly to stop in front of me with the expression of a person managing multiple complicated things simultaneously. "Ms. Voss, I was coming to find you. What happened?" He was quiet for one beat too long. "Elder Cassian raised the question of your continued residence here in formal terms, during the council session." He paused. He framed it as a security concern. The presence of a civilian with no PAC affiliation during a period of territorial sensitivity. I took this in. He wants me to leave. He made a formal recommendation. The king overruled it. Riven's expression didn't change, but something in his voice was very carefully flat, in the way that meant he was managing his own response to what he was describing. "Immediately and without deliberation." That must have gone over well. Elder Cassian used the word unprecedented. A pause. The king used several words in return. "I won't repeat them verbatim, but the outcome is that you and your brother remain here without qualification, and the council's formal standing on the matter has been made clear." I pressed my back against the wall and stared at the opposite wall. "He didn't tell me this was a discussion," I said. "I believe he didn't want you to feel that your position here was conditional," Riven said. "He didn't want you managing that uncertainty while your brother was still in the medical wing." The ceiling of the corridor was old plaster, finely cracked in patterns that looked almost like maps. I had been noticing this for days, the way the cracks branched and intersected, the way the light caught them differently depending on the hour. "Riven," I said, "when does he leave for the Eastern Territories?" "Day after tomorrow. I need to speak with him this evening." Something shifted in Riven's careful expression. Not quite a smile, but the structural possibility of one. "He'll be in the courtyard," he said. "He usually is." I got there before him. I sat on the bench under the bare oak tree with my hands in my lap and the cold coming in properly now. Autumn no longer arriving, but fully arrived. And I thought about what I wanted to say and discarded each version until I had something that was true without being more than what I knew yet. And then I sat with the truth of it for a while in the dark. He came through the door at the usual hour. He stopped when he saw me. And in the pale light from the windows, something in his face went briefly unguarded, in a way I had only seen that one other time, when he'd told me about Venna. I stood up. "You didn't tell me Cassian was trying to remove me," I said. "I want to be clear that I understand why, and I'm not angry about it. But I want you to know, I don't need to be protected from information about my own situation. I'm not fragile." "I know you're not fragile," he said. He stopped a few feet away. "You stayed 3 extra days, I said. "Past when you needed to go. Because of..." I paused. "Because this place is hard to leave." "Yes," he said simply. "Venna would want you to go," I said very quietly. "Because I believed it was true, and because I thought he needed to hear it more than I needed to be cautious about saying it. She would want the thing she is a reason for, to keep being a reason." The silence that followed was the longest one we had ever shared. When he finally spoke, his voice was different, not broken, nothing like that, but with something in it that had been held down for a very long time and had just been allowed to surface. "I'll return," he said, "when the negotiations are resolved." "I know," I said. "The Institute will still be here." "I wasn't talking about the Institute." The bare branches moved above us. One last leaf, somehow still clinging, let go. I looked at him across the stone bench, and the cooling air, and the whole complicated territory of everything still unsaid. And I felt it. That thing Eli had noticed, that compression releasing, some long-held weight redistributing itself into something more like foundation than burden. "Then we'll both be here," I said. And for the first time, he smiled. Not the corner-of-the-mouth impression of one. A real smile, brief and unguarded and entirely itself. Then he nodded once, and the evening held it, and the bare tree held it, and I held it. Lucian left on a Thursday morning, before the light had fully decided what it was going to do with the day. I didn't go to see him off. We hadn't discussed it, and somehow the not discussing felt like its own kind of agreement, that goodbyes performed for an audience were a different thing from what existed between us, and we didn't need to make a production of a door that was staying open. I heard the vehicles on the gravel drive from my window while I was dressing, and I stood for a moment with my hands still and my eyes on the courtyard below, where the oak tree stood bare and patient in the gray morning light, and I said nothing out loud, but thought something that I didn't yet have the right words for. Then I braided my hair, put on my cloak, and went to sit with Eli. The weeks that followed were their own country, as I said. Eli improved with a consistency that Cato described as textbook, which I understood to mean as well as we could have hoped delivered in medical vocabulary. By the end of the fourth week, he was sitting up for most of the day. By the fifth, he was walking the corridor outside his room with the careful, deliberate steps of someone relearning a thing the body had temporarily forgotten. By the sixth, he was arguing with Rue about the precise composition of the tea she kept bringing him, which Rue received with the patient satisfaction of someone who considers strong opinions about herbal remedies a sign of returning vitality. I watched him come back to himself the way I had watched the Institute's courtyard tree through the window. Incrementally, without drama. The way real and lasting things tend to happen. I documented it internally with the same attention I gave to old buildings. Noting each small change, each recovered detail. Understanding that the record of a thing's survival matters as much as the survival itself. Dara became a genuine friend in the way that sometimes happens when you are both temporarily removed from your ordinary lives and must build connection from whatever is actually present rather than from shared history or convenience. She was 22, training in what she described as territorial communications, a role I gradually understood to mean something like diplomatic liaison between packs. And she had an honesty so uncalculated it occasionally took my breath away. "You're waiting," she said one afternoon, sitting across from me in the library while I worked on preservation forms, and she worked on something involving maps covered in territorial notations. "I'm working," I said. "You're also waiting." She said it without accusation, just as information. "That's fine. Waiting is fine. I just want you to know that I notice and I think it's..." She searched for the word. "Brave. In a quiet way." I looked at her. "Most people fill waiting time with noise," she said. "You don't. You just hold it. I think that's actually very hard to do, and most people don't recognize it as a skill." I thought about this for a long time after she went back to her maps. Riven stayed. This surprised me initially. I had assumed he would travel with Lucian to the Eastern Territories. But Sable explained with her customary brisk efficiency that Riven's role at the Institute was equally primary, that Lucian had other security arrangements for the territorial negotiations, and that Riven preferred the Institute. He was not easy company in the way Dara was easy company. He was quiet in a way that was about watchfulness rather than peace, and he looked at everything as if assessing its threat potential, which could feel wearing until you understood that it wasn't personal. It was simply how he experienced the world, and he had made a kind of accommodation with it. He checked on Eli with a regularity that was professional but not cold. He updated me on travel conditions and negotiation timelines with the same flat, informational tone he used for everything. On day 31, he found me in the library at an unusual hour, past 10 in the evening, when I couldn't sleep and had come to sit among the old paper smell rather than stare at my ceiling. And sat across from me without a particular agenda, which was unusual enough that I looked up from my book. "The Eastern negotiation reached a preliminary agreement today," he said. I set the book down. "That's... he'll be back within the week." Riven looked at the table, then at me. "I wanted you to know before the official communication. He asked me to tell you directly." I pressed my palms flat on the table. The same gesture I realized as that first morning in the hospital chapel, grounding myself against the weight of something shifting. "Is he all right?" I asked. He is. A pause. He's better than he's been in some time. The negotiations went well, which matters, but that's not entirely what I mean. Riven studied me with his assessor's eyes, and this time the assessment felt different. Not threat evaluating, but something more considered. He checks in with the Institute's medical records daily. He has since he left. Eli's progress reports. Another pause. He doesn't usually do that. I looked at the ceiling of the library, at the bookshelves tall enough to require a rolling ladder, at the lamp throwing warm light across the table between us. Riven, I said carefully. The Council, Doran and Cassian and Marin, they're not wrong that this is complicated. His position, his responsibilities, what people expect of him. No, Riven said. They're not wrong about the complexity, but... He was quiet for a moment. Venna died 4 years ago. In the time since, he has run two Pact territories through a succession dispute, negotiated the accord revisions, built and expanded this institute, and managed the eastern border situation without sleep that I would consider adequate by any standard. He looked at his hands. He does all of it. All of it every day, without... There is very little in his life that is only for him. Very little that isn't also a responsibility or a duty, or a proof of something to someone. He looked at me. You are not a complication, Ms. Voss. You are the first thing in 4 years that has been simply good, without requiring anything in return. I sat with that for a long time. Thank you, I said, for telling me. He nodded once, the same single nod I had learned from someone else, and stood up and left me with the books and the lamp, and the particular quality of stillness that comes after something true has been said in a quiet room. He came back on a Wednesday. I knew the hour, Dara told me, with unconcealed excitement, because Dara never concealed anything. And I spent the morning sitting with Eli, who was well enough now that our conversations had returned to their ordinary shape, the comfortable rhythms of two people who have known each other their whole lives. Tell me about him, Eli said. Direct, Eli style, no preamble. So I did. Not everything. Some things were still in the process of being understood, but enough. The chapel, the bench, the tea, the smile, brief and real and entirely itself, that last evening in the courtyard. Eli listened with his eyes closed, which was how he always listened to things he was taking seriously. When I finished, he was quiet for a moment. You know what I think? He said. I usually do, I said. I think you have spent your whole life being the person who holds things for other people. The one who stays, who documents, who preserves. And I think it is long past time that someone held something for you. He opened his eyes. Does he do that? I thought about a voice calibrated to fit inside stone walls. I thought about a cup of tea left at his end of the bench. I thought about I wasn't talking about the Institute. Yes, I said. I think he does. Eli nodded. Good. And then, he's going to have to explain the whole Alpha King situation to me at some point. I'll let him know. I'm serious, Lily. I have questions, structural questions, about the hierarchy. I know you do. I was in the courtyard when he arrived. Not waiting, or not only waiting. I had come out because the afternoon light was doing something specific to the bare branches of the oak tree, a low gold that made the whole thing look illuminated from within, and I had wanted to see it. And I had my notebook out and was writing a description of it with the same attention I gave to old buildings, because some things deserve a record. I heard the door. I didn't look up immediately. I finished the sentence I was writing. The light makes the branches look like something that chose to be bare rather than something that lost its leaves. And then I set the pen down and looked up. He stood at the edge of the courtyard. He looked, returned. That was the word. not just physically present but returned to himself in some way, some quality restored that the weight of the past weeks had compressed. He was still in traveling clothes, still carrying the particular tiredness of someone who has been in motion for a long time. But underneath the tiredness was something steadier than what I had seen on the evenings he'd come to this courtyard, carrying the heaviness of things he couldn't put down. He crossed to the bench. He sat. The same 4 feet of space. The same bench. The same bare tree. "How is he?" he asked. "Walking on his own since last week," I said. "Arguing with Rue about tea. Asking structural questions about pack hierarchy that he says are for me but are clearly for himself." The real smile again. Unhurried this time. Not brief. It stayed. "The negotiation," I said. "Resolved. Provisional boundary agreement. Joint Development Commission. Review in 18 months. He said it with the tone of someone recounting the contents of a completed task rather than a triumph. "Doran is satisfied. Cassian is satisfied. Myron drafted the documentation personally, which means she approves. And you?" He looked at the tree. "I am glad it is done." The light was changing, the low gold deepening toward amber, and the oak held it in its bare branches the way bare things sometimes hold light better than full ones do. "Lily," he said. "Yes. I would like..." He stopped. Started again with the careful precision of someone who does not say things they don't mean, and is therefore deliberate about what they choose to say. "When your brother is well enough to leave, when your life returns to its ordinary shape, I would like that shape to include this, to include the Institute, to include..." He paused once more. "Visits. Correspondence. The chance to sit in this courtyard and continue what we've started here. Properly. Without the circumstances that made it necessary in the first place." I looked at him. "I'm not a person who asks for things easily," he said. "Honest, unadorned. I find I am asking." The amber light settled over the courtyard. The oak tree stood in it, patient and bare and entirely itself. From inside the building I could hear, distantly, Eli's voice saying something emphatic to Rue, and Rue's response, and then Dara's laugh cutting bright through both. "Yes," I said. "Simple. Complete. The right-sized word for what it was carrying." He exhaled, quietly once, and something in the lines of his face settled into a configuration I hadn't seen before, but recognized immediately as rest. We sat in the courtyard as the light finished its long, slow deepening into evening, and the first star appeared above the tree line, and the bare branches held their patterns against the darkening sky. And neither of us needed to fill the silence, because the silence was already full. In the weeks that followed, Eli was discharged from the Varek Institute on a bright November morning, walking out under his own power with Cato shaking his hand, and Rue pressing a wrapped package of herbal blends into his arms, with the firm instruction that he was to continue the regimen without deviation. Dara hugged me with the unceremonious warmth of someone who has decided you are permanent and is not embarrassed about it. Riven shook my hand and said Ms. Voss with a gravity that managed to contain considerable warmth within its formality. Eli met Lucian in the entrance hall. I watched my brother look at him, that long, assessing, older brother look. And I watched Lucian receive it without deflection, which I thought was the correct response. "I have questions," Eli said, "about the hierarchy." "I expected you would," Lucian said. "We can discuss it." Eli glanced at me. I kept my face neutral. He looked back at Lucian with the expression that means acceptable, provisionally. We returned to the city. Eli came back to the apartment slowly, reclaiming his ordinary life with the careful deliberateness of someone who understood now that ordinary life was a thing worth claiming carefully. He didn't go back to the shipping yard. There were conversations and changes, and a quiet negotiation with what his body could and would do going forward. He was, in the end, all right. Better than all right, He was alive in a way that had more intention in it than before. More awareness of the fact that alive is not a guarantee. I went back to my preservation work. Back to documenting old buildings, the original fixtures, the structural elements covered over by time and renovation, and the general human tendency to look forward and call it progress. Back to making records so that things that changed still had a history, but the shape of my life had changed. Quietly, without announcement. The way most real changes happen. Lucian came to the city 3 weeks after we left the Institute. He sat in the small restaurant near my office that I had mentioned once in passing, the one with the uneven floors and the windows overlooking the old quarter. And we talked for 3 hours about everything and nothing, about preservation and loss and the difference between the two, about Eli's structural questions, which turned out to be genuine and thoughtful, about the oak tree and whether it would hold its bare shape through the winter or surprise everyone. He came again the following month, and the month after that. I visited the Institute in January, when the grounds were covered in snow and the courtyard looked entirely different and entirely the same. Rue had reorganized the medicinal plant library. Dara had been promoted, a fact she delivered with the studied casualness of someone very pleased, but attempting to seem merely informational. Riven was exactly as he had always been, which I had come to understand was its own kind of reliability. Cato had framed a photograph of Eli's discharge on the wing 3 wall. Among the others, a wall of photographs, I realized, of people who had come here and left better than they arrived. Not a small collection. Years of them. I stood in front of that wall for a long time. This was what Lucian had built in the shape of his grief. Not a monument. Not a declaration. A place where people who had run out of options found another option. Quietly, without fanfare. Without requiring anything of them, except the willingness to stay long enough to let the help work. I thought about a candle burning down to nothing in a cold chapel. I thought about a voice saying you don't have to leave. I thought about the specific quality of sitting next to someone in the dark who does not require you to perform being fine. I thought about Eli saying you're less compressed. I thought about Dara saying brave, in a quiet way. Some things don't resolve with a single moment. They resolve the way seasons change, not on a specific day, but across a series of days, each one slightly different from the one before, until you look up one morning and understand that what you're living in now is not what you were living in before, and the distance between the two is made up of all the ordinary moments you passed through to get here. I am 24 years old. I am a person who documents what persists. I am a person who sat in a hospital chapel at midnight with nowhere left to go and found someone already there, sitting in the same dark, equally without answers. We did not fix each other. That is not what this was. What this was, two people with separate griefs and separate histories and separate responsibilities, who happened to occupy the same silence at the same moment and discovered that the silence was more bearable shared, and who chose, deliberately and without guarantees, to keep sharing it. On a Thursday in late February, gray sky, the first suggestion of something that might eventually become spring, Lucian arrived at my office building with no announcement and no particular agenda. I came downstairs and found him standing on the sidewalk looking at the facade of the building with an expression I recognized. "It's 18th century," I said. "The original stonework is under 2 layers of later renovation. You can see where the original window proportions were altered here," I pointed. "And here." He looked where I pointed. Then he looked at me. "Show me," he said. So I did. We walked the building's perimeter in the gray February light, and I showed him what was there, and what had been covered over, and what had survived unchanged. And he listened with the quality of attention that made everything worth saying, and the city moved around us in its ordinary way, indifferent and constant. And we were two people standing in the middle of it with the full knowledge of everything we'd come through to be standing there. This was not a beginning. We were already well past beginning. This was just life, continuing, carrying its history forward into something new. And that, I thought, was exactly enough.